Blog Talk Radio.
Well, I've had one too many cigarettes burning up my lungs. Had to taste of one too many lips hanging off my tongue. Oh, oh, oh. Sunday morning getting high, drinking here alone, thinking up a brand new alibi for not coming home. Oh, oh.
Celebrate people who, like the founder of the show, recognize they are on a dangerous path and make the difficult adjustment to be an amazing person. Share the poems that reveal the duality of our vulnerability and strength. Capture the internal battle of the demon and angel on your shoulder. Deep poetry, thoughtful commentary, and fun chatter for sinners, saints, and everyone in between. This is Part Sinner, Part Saint on Late Night Poets. And we are a group on allpoetry.com. You don't have to be in the group to participate, but it's more fun if you are, because you can chat with me in the chat, and we can read the poems together. I have two guests with me tonight. I have Robert. Hello, Robert.
Hello. Can you hear me?
I can, yes. Thank you for being here.
Not a problem. It's been a while.
It has. Oh, it's good to have you back. I also see I have someone else who I don't recognize their phone number. Who else is with us? Area code 801?
It's Tressa.
Tressa?
Yeah.
Hi. Great. Welcome. All right. So today we are going to celebrate The album called Signs of Life by Neil Gaiman and 4-Play String Quartet, and I used the poem The Wreckers as a prompt for many of the poems tonight. There is one poem carried over from my other show, but it was also a Neil Gaiman quote, so it fits. And we're going to start with that one. But first, Tressa, do you have an AP username that I might know you by?
It's Tressa Rose.
Tressa Rose. Okay, great. Awesome. So I think that is familiar. But did you have one in this contest?
Yeah, that's what it should be under.
Okay. Great. All right. So our first one that we're going to do is the one that's a carryover. And the prompt for that one was, "And all the memories of pain and joy that only we shared, I am custodian, but all of our words are writ on water." So that was a quote by Neil Gaiman. And the response to it is by S.E. DeHaven. It's called Relic. Relic, 1. Long dead hands dancing with hook and needle, weaving tatting thread into lush roses, crimson, cherry and vermilion, overblown in a snowy field of tablecloth, doily spider-spun and well-blocked, a soft thing to make the cheapest chipboard table, something pretty. 2. It never stayed long in the cedar chest, passed from hand to hand, pressed to descendant cheek, gathered in the fists of babies who opened their eyes decades after you closed yours. Your meisterstruck, your rosy rhapsody, your crocheted epitaph, a grave marker worked by your own fingers, a memory made material, bone white, blood red, and immortal. 3. I wonder, will my efforts in pen and ink, in living words, will they remember me as kindly as your rose tablecloth remembers you? End poem. Robert, would you like to comment?
Yeah. I really like the imagery here with all the colors, like the roses, crimson, cherry, and vermilion. You know, I like the inclusion of that. As you know, I'm a very visual person, and colors really helped me to kind of draw me in. And I thought that this was an interesting take on the prompt in the sense that it seems kind of as though it's like a family heirloom being passed around. But obviously there's deeper metaphor in there. I like the it never stayed long in the cedar chest, passed from one hand to hand, pressed to descendant cheek, gathered in the fist of babies who opened their eyes decades after you closed yours, your meisterstruck. It shows that a lot of things, like, whether they be material or not, in this case it is a material possession, but can be passed down and appreciated for years long after they're long after you're gone, or long after their initial purpose, you know, the reason that they were created. And I think that is a very valuable and beautiful sentiment, in my opinion.
Great comment. And Tessa, what were your thoughts? You may be muted. Tessa? Okay, I'll go. I really enjoyed the way that this used the details of the item that's been passed on. So to think of it as not just a tablecloth, but something that was carefully made by hand, and that it's passed from hand to hand. It has a very tactile connection to it. And something about threads and needles, it makes me think about, like, the Norns and the various mythological figures where it's the wise women who create kind of, like, the paths of destiny and the connections, whereas this possibly great-great-grandmother has woven a piece that will, well, crocheted, not necessarily weaving, has made something that is being passed down throughout generations and connecting those family members to each other. I liked when it talked about how it makes anything feel like it's pretty. It's on the cheapest chipboard table, and it doesn't matter how well off the various generations of the family are. They have this piece of their heritage that makes it beautiful. The passing down in the cedar chest is kind of a familiar thing. I remember my grandmother and my mother both had, like, they called it their hope chest, and it would have all of the kind of hand-me-down heirloom-type things in it, but it doesn't stay long in that chest. It gets actually used. I like that it's in the fists of babies. I can just picture that chubby little hand going around it, and that it uses the eyes. They open their eyes decades after you close yours, so even though those babies never got to meet their ancestor, possibly, they got the connection of that family, and that's beautiful. And I like the question at the end of, you know, will this person, the narrator, be remembered as strongly? Will their writing continue on? Like the physical crafts of past generations, will they be thought of kindly by their oh my God, descendants? I was trying to think of the opposite of ancestor, descendants and their extended family. I think it's a good question about legacy, because it doesn't have to be something that you actually, you know, physically made, or that you necessarily created and literally left behind, but will your efforts, will your all the essence of you be carried on? And I think that's something that everyone kind of wonders about, in what part of them will be remembered, and will it be fondly or not? Tessa, are you with us again? Oh, nope. She has dropped. Okay. So I see Robbie on the board. Hello. Now we have the main event of using the wreckers as the prompt. I'm actually going to play a recording of the wreckers. So this is by Neil Gaiman. He's the voice and the author. And four-play string quartet did the background music, which is so beautiful. So here we have the wreckers.
Moments of surprise that leave you wrecked. The wreckers on the old black Cornish rocks, when there was no moonlight and hard storms pushed the waves and winds to treachery, would would light their lamps to lure the ships ashore. And ships who thought that they were safe and lights were there to guide them home would run aground, all hands lost and stolen by the cold sea. To share the good times is to share the bad times. To share the joy in the fine wine times is to drink the wine down to the bottom of the glass where things are bitter. I will not ask for any glass to pass from me. There are no accidents. Or possibly there are. But things happen because of their nature. And there is no arguing with nature, for she is wise and innocent and cruel, and rage and hurt and pain and blood are hers. So we build rituals of mourning and acceptance to walk us through the nights of tears and pain. But nature lost a daughter who remains 6 seeds of pomegranate dead today. Three things I send you. First, I send these words, that you may use them as a pool of ink, to see yourself reflected, or see another in, to see faraway things, so you do not forget to dream. And then I send you pain, a small pain, to whisper to your pain, and keep it company. And last, I send a smile, that it might serve you well, and you may hold it in a time when smiles are scarce. Remembering the moonlight on the water.
I am so in love with Neil Gaiman. It's like a serious problem. I was just blown away by this, so that's why I decided to make it a prompt. I am mesmerized by his words, by his voice, and I, like Robbie said on the board, that he thought that it was so atmospheric, and I have to agree. I mean, the music just works so perfectly with his words. So I have to admire the four-play string quartet for how perfectly it was paired. So that was the inspiration for the contest in general, and it's broken down into smaller bits in our prompts. Prompt one was, to share the joy in the fine wine times is to drink the wine down to the bottom of the glass where things are bitter. And this one is by Ima Rima. Robert, would you read that one for me, please?
I'll give it a shot. To Death in Sips by Ima Rima. Uncork that last bottle of mine and pour it into a crystal glass. Sense the bouquet of the fine wine, a departing pleasure, alas. With a finger, the wine I stir to mix up with the poison well. Upon drinking, what will occur? Will I go to heaven or hell? I'm liking living less and less. I guess I didn't expect much more, and expected too much, I guess. My life has become such a bore. Put down the emptied glass to meet my end of time here, bittersweet, end poem.
Excellent read. And this is a powerful write, you know, the contemplation of suicide, but said in such a beautiful way. I think it's a sonnet. I could be wrong. It has the rhyming pairs and then the thing at the end. I have not counted the syllables or anything, but it's some kind of formal format that works well with the language choices, and it had a nice rhythm to it. I like that he actually, I don't know if I'm a man or a woman. I like that the poet uses questions, too, of wondering what will happen. Is it heaven or hell? Curious about what could be, and knowing that expectations in life have not been met. So what could be of the afterlife? Is that going to be an improvement? Or is it going to be even worse? There's a pessimism to this, and yet it also seems like there's a savoring of that last bottle, the enjoyment of the last little bit before the end. And there is the bittersweetness that it actually says, because it's like going out on a good note of enjoying that and in the finery of the crystal glass, but it's, you know, to choose death is so serious. And it's just, I'm speechless, but I thought this was very well done. What did you think, Robert?
Yeah, it was short and sweet, to say the least. I did like the kind of like philosophy in here, you know, the wondering and the questions, like you mentioned. But it also was like kind of like to the point, but in a way that wasn't necessarily starkly direct, but it was in a kind of led you along little by little, like, this is what's happening, this is what's going on. And then, you know, you end up at the end. I do like the questions, like to mix up with the poison well, upon drinking, what will occur? Will I go to heaven or hell? You know, there's still that little ponderance there, and it's like pondering about like what could happen. And but you know, it's kind of those things that we do when we're in a position that there's no coming back from, or there's no way out of. We tend to, what is that word? We tend to try to make up another ending, like another possibility, like maybe it won't be, you know, hell, you know, maybe it'll be something else. And I like the very humanistic nature of this piece and the darkness within it, as well as it being as beautiful as it was. Like they really did well with the crystal glass and the stirring of the wine with the finger and just kind of setting the tone. And I thought they did a great job.
Well said. I see we have another caller. And I think that's Robbie. Robbie, is that you?
Yes, it is. I had to call in and indulge in my little man crush on Neil Gaiman. So
I was like, on Robert? Okay, on Neil Gaiman.
Whoa. No.
I mean, there's lots to go. I've got to get you guys not confused, though. Robert, Robbie, very, very close names. All right, Robbie, do you have comments about our poem here?
Well, I was thinking of a term that came to my mind for a couple of poems on another show, and it's kind of this the idea of radical self-acceptance. And but in a different way here, it's kind of like an acceptance that, you know, and this is like that dark turn, like, you know, where someone's saying, you know, maybe it's almost like here, like they feel like life doesn't have a meaning. And like it's in, you know, where it says my life has become such a bore. And I've seen that a couple of times in movies where someone says that line or someone says something like that, and they say it in such a dulled, almost cowed voice, like, you know, oh, life is just so boring. And it's said in a way that it's not just like, I'm a little bored, but more like that existential crisis sort of a way, like life is such a, has become such a profound bore that I just don't see the point in staying around anymore. You know, there's no challenge left. There's no new adventures, that sort of thing. So that's what came in the most for me on this poem. And there's a couple of parts that that almost had like a Shakespearean touch to it, like a departing pleasure, a laugh. I don't know why, but that it made me think of with Shakespeare, like parting is such sweet sorrow. And because you know, sweet sorrow. And there's a couple of times here where, like bittersweet, and there's a mixture here of like goodness and dread.
Indeed. Our next poem is by the fabulous Pam Ray. And Pam is one of our hostesses on Late Night Poets. She's not here tonight, but she did make us a recording, which I am always grateful for. So here we have Pam Ray.
Pomegranate wine. The pomegranate wine paints my lips. I inhale the flirtatious breeze of spring, while soaking sunlight with sultry sips. Fairy hands caress the sway of fairy hips, spirits fluttering on freedom's wing. The pomegranate wine paints my lips, while in the distance sinks the ships, the bride beholds the wedding ring, while soaking sunlight with sultry sips. Growing trees stretch budding tips, there's magic found in everything. The pomegranate wine paints my lips. Lovers are laced in arrows' nips, delightful rides upon the swing, while soaking sunlight with sultry sips. Gods have hands with fickle grips that pull back the hunter's string, while soaking sunlight with sultry sips. In the raging storm, the flower strips, while life and death comes to pauper and king. The pomegranate wine paints my lips, while soaking sunlight with sultry sips. End poem.
Ooh, Pam. That was a great read, and I'm so happy we got to hear it in your own voice. This actually combines several of the prompts, because she said it was the prompt one, and it does work with prompt one with the wine, but also because it's pomegranate wine, it works with a later prompt that deals with Penelope, because it has but nature lost a daughter who remains six seeds of pomegranate dead today. So Demeter losing her, not Penelope, what am I saying? Persephone?
Yeah,
Persephone, okay. Start with a P. Okay, Persephone. Demeter lost her daughter to the underworld because Persephone ate the pomegranate offered in hell, and she was trapped there. So that it's pomegranate wine is a connection to that myth. pomegranate being the temptation often has kind of a sexual connotation to it. So the pomegranate wine, that is, you know, part of the flirtatious nature. Here it talks a lot about, like, the hands on the hips and the lovers laced in arrows' nips. I mean, she definitely went with that aspect of the pomegranate. When it says gods have hands with fickle grips that pulls back the hunter's string, that kind of makes me think about how the Greek gods tended to be very promiscuous, but in ways that caused trouble. You know, Zeus sleeping with all the humans and creating demigods that his wife was upset and tended to go after the women who he had affairs with, caused lots of problems. And it's a fickle grip because he changes his mind and goes for a new girl in every story. And then the hunter's string, it makes me think about, like, Cupid's bow, and it's when it pulls back the hunter's string, someone is getting struck by love, or at least by lust, and that's taking them down into those sultry sips that cause trouble again. But then it says, death comes to the pauper and the king. It doesn't matter what your station is in life. Eventually, you know, love and death are the end for all of us. You can't avoid it. And the pomegranate continues to paint her lips, and it's a good thing and it's a bad thing. So I think that really works well with our prompt here. And she says that it is a villanelle as the format. Robert, what did you think?
Yeah, I thought the format was interesting. I can never do this type of format like I've tried before, and I just can't wrap my head around it. So, you know, I have mad respect for people who can. And she did a great job with it. Like when I heard her reading it, I was like, wow, this is different. You know, because she doesn't, well, at least I haven't noticed. But from what I've known, I haven't seen her use the style very much. But, you know what's weird about it is while I was reading it, like all the lines that end with the ing, like spring and wing, those lines by themselves, I don't know if it was intentional or not, but if you put them all together, it's like a separate poem. Like, I inhale the flirtatious breeze of spring, spirits fluttering on freedom's wing. The bride beholds the wedding ring. There's magic found in everything, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So, like, you go along, and just those lines alone create their own poem. And I don't know, like I said, if that was intentional or not, but I thought it was great. And then the whole the use of the sultry sips and paints my lips repetition or refrain or whatever they call it. I thought it was a nice touch because it keeps you engaged, you know, through the whole thing with such vibrant visuals, you know. So, yeah, I thought Pam did a great job with this. She killed the prompt, so, as she always does. So, great job, Pam.
She does, doesn't she? Pam can take any prompt and just make it her own. Love that. Robbie, how did you like it?
Like you said, I'm almost getting mixed up. Like, I almost unmuted and started talking when you said Robert, but like, no, it's Robbie, not Robert. That happens a lot when Robert's on. It's like, wait, especially because my last name starts with M. So it's like, oh, no, wait, they're talking to Robert, not me. But anyways, so with this, I like especially how with the picture and the grapes or the pomegranate that they have there, and that it's kind of like you were saying, you know, the good and the bad. Like with the picture, it kind of shows to me how with wine, you know, the sweetness and the tartness, so to speak, of life are there for us all. Like no one has life that's all sweet or mostly, you know, all bitter. And I thought a villanelle was a very good format to use for this sort of poem, because it has that very gentle, impactful sort of a feel to it. And I can't say exactly why, but somehow a villanelle fits that feeling very well. And it really drew me in with how the sentences ended. And to me, that's kind of like how the experience of wine, really, like a fine wine really draws you in and keeps you there. So that feeling of what a good taste of wine is like, it really paralleled well with the poem.
That's a good way to put it. I'm not much of a wine drinker myself, but I will take your word for it. Robbie,
like
I'm going to put you to work
wine.
Now. Yeah, I'm more of a sweet drinker, and because I hang out in this kind of like Viking reenactment thing. We drink a lot of mead. My house is currently like a freaking meadery. My husband's decided to try all different kinds of ways of making mead. So we have so much mead going on. It's just like honey and fruit everywhere. Hopefully it turns out. I had a friend whose bubbled right and it exploded. I'm like, please don't explode all over the place. Yeah. I'm going to get you, Robbie, to read the one by Keng, please.
All right. I like meadery, by the way. I'm just imagining a Simpsons episode called Meadery, and Homer starts like a meadery in his home, and it turns into a disaster. So this is Romance in a Sauvignon. Soft, golden, liquid glades, God's lake in a glass. In it, yellowed liquor's wine. A smile across, cannot let pass. Not a glance. More meeting eyes, moment pass. The conversation lasts till romance letters sweep the midnight moon. Folded arms cross her arms. Lake cross, hook to hungry lips. She folds in golden, in soft golden liquid glades of you. End poem.
That was great. I like the way that he uses the color to connect it, the soft golden liquid, because it's not just like, you know, like yellow or what have you. Gold just makes it seem extra fancy. And like to say God's lake in a glass, also just beautifully worded. Not a glance. More meeting eyes, moment past minutes, a conversation lasts till romance letters sweep the midnight moon. That's, you know, it's a very romantic piece. And it goes back into the golden later on, and liquid glades of you. That's just, you know, it's digging into the sensuality some more. Her arms, legs cross, hook to hungry lips. This seems more like the joy part of the fine times, and not as much of the bitterness gets in this one compared to some of the other responses. Robert, what were your thoughts?
Yeah. I really like the second stanza a lot. A smile across cannot let pass, not a glance, more meeting eyes, moment past to minutes, a conversation lasts till romance, letters sweep the midnight moon. I, for one, I'm always a sucker for the moon in poetry. And but that was just masterfully done, I think. Like, the way to describe it is very beautiful. And the folded arms cross her arms, legs cross, hooked to hungry lips, she folds in soft golden liquid glades of you. I was thinking like a, you know, at the end, you know, where the wine takes effect, and it, you know, during the euphoric part, the other people become like your company, depending on how good of a company you have, they can often become the ambrosia, you know, like the amplify the high or the comfort or whatever to make you feel just kind of like top it off, you know, like this really caps the night off. And I thought that was a beautiful sentiment at the end. Liquid glades of you. I would have never thought to put that in a poem like that, but it worked out well. And like you said, it's very romantic, I think, and has all the hits all the notes. So yeah.
Yes, I feel like this could also work for the Wednesday night show, the Art of Seduction.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those poems that could work in many different I don't know, platforms, but I really liked it. Robbie, what did you think?
Well, I laughed when I heard "Top It Off" because it just played tangentially into what I was saying in the chat, that I kept topping off a glass of wine during New Year's one year, and then like half an hour, 45 minutes later, I'm like, oh my God, I haven't finished my glass of wine technically, because I kept topping it off, and 45 minutes later, I'm still on. You could kind of say I was on the same glass of wine, so that gave me a chuckle. But it was such a pleasure for me to read. This is like unique for me in terms of there's just a certain something about this poem that the way it was written combined with the imagery, like it's almost like, and I almost want to write something myself now because it made me feel like I fell into the glass of wine that was in this poem. It was just, this poem was so like at ease with itself, for how pretentious that phrase maybe sounds. But it's just like, I don't know, the imagery in it, it just sustained the feeling of the poem so well, and it's in such a gentle manner. And and I love some of the images here. They're just so elegant, and it's like that sensuality, but like such a soft sensuality in soft golden liquid glades of you. I mean, that's just so, it's just, yeah, it's such a nice call to nature and sensuality at the same time. And yeah, it just made it such a pleasure to read.
Well, I think that's a really good sign of a great write when it inspires you and you want to write. I do find that with novels, if there's something that I really love to read, then sometimes it will make me want to write. And like, especially if someone has like some really good just use of language in ways that are creative. And I'm like, why don't I do stuff like that? And it's not like I'm going to copy exactly what they wrote, but it just gets you thinking about like the way of looking at things. I saw this, I can't remember what it was. It was like some kind of like editorial cartoon or something. Maybe a meme that joked about how, when you've read a really good novel, you start, narrating your life internally like that. And it had like a person buying a donut, but the description of it was like, I sauntered into the place and gathered I can't even remember what it said, but it was like just a really fancy way of saying like I bought a donut, but it was like narrating as she did the thing. And it was just like, yes, you get that sort of way of when you're hearing something in such a beautiful manner, it's like, I wish that I spoke like that, or it clearly I'm not, because I'm like mumbling, like babbling. But I see what you mean with that inspiration, where it's really good and you just want to go with that flow.
What made me scared if someone was inspired by 50 Shades of Grey like that? And they started narrating their life like 50 Shades of Grey, but like, I don't know, you keep that narration to yourself, buddy.
I don't know.
Well,
after Victoria used to have a show that was like the fun, naughty stuff. Now, personally, I didn't like 50 Shades. I think he's kind of like borderline abusive, and that it wasn't good representation of S&M. But yeah, when Victoria used to have the naughty show, that was hot. So it was totally different. It
mm-hmm.
changes the narration. God, I missed that show. I got to get Victoria to do it again. Our next poem by Avelina is Scarlet Hues. My heart does burn with rage. My soul is a canvas painted with anger by those I cherished. I have used my blood for paint, and the scarlet hues can't hide the hurt. Okay, sorry, I need to stop for a sec because I realized I did not give context. So I'm going to go back because this is prompt two now. And prompt two is, there is no arguing with nature, for she is wise and innocent and cruel, and rage and hurt and pain and blood are hers. So this is a different prompt than the other ones. And now I'm going to start again because I felt like Avelina deserved to be in context. Scarlet Hues. My heart does burn with rage. My soul is a canvas painted with anger by those I cherished. I have used my blood for paint, and the scarlet hues can't hide the hurt. Betrayed by love, by people who were supposed to care, yet a flicker light my eyes, a fire fierce when I think of my daughter and how I need her to see my strength. I begin to rise, like a phoenix born from ashes. I will rise. I am here to reclaim my precious life. I can't even tell you how it feels to no longer be silenced by their lies. I am not used to this peace. It doesn't feel real. I am becoming a masterpiece of strength that they can't steal. I keep going because I see the way she looks at me. For in my confidence, she finds her confidence. Confidence to break the chains and the generational curses that she saw bound her mama. I will teach her not to cower. She will see me embracing scars as signs of growth and gain. She will see me rise from this pain. End poem. Robert, would you like to comment?
Yeah, firstly, Avelina is one of my favorite people on this site. Known her for quite a while, and she's always brilliant and soulful with her work. But yeah, this I'm sure many can relate to this. Of course, the part where it says, betrayed by love, by people who were supposed to care, yet a flicker in my eyes. A fire fierce when I think of my daughter and how I need her to see my strength. She's just a great person, like outside of poetry and in her poetry. She's an awesome and inspiring person. And to see her like express this with such vigor and ferocity and like kind of like a defensive stance and to be like a role model like for her daughter, it's also inspiring because like when I was listening to you read it and it kind of like channeled a bit of it into myself, and I'm like, man, this is epic, like it's one of those feelings that really grabs you and pulls you and makes you feel it. And I always admire her work for that because her work is usually very raw, and this is no different. This is very raw and powerful emotion. And I think she did the prompt justice too. And yeah, like the entire prompt, I think she nailed it. So yeah, I'm glad to hear a piece by her and glad she decided to enter and get some writing done.
Me too. Avelina is wonderful. And I just felt like this was so empowering reading it. I felt like full of her strength. You know, it pumped me up to be reading this out loud. And I love that she's becoming that fierce version of herself for herself, but also for her daughter. You know, wanting to be that role model. And I think a lot of people get to become their best selves because they realize that someone's looking up to them, and it encourages them to keep trying when life is discouraging, to show their children that they can succeed, and to realize that as she gains confidence, her daughter does as well. And there's so much strength in how direct this is. You know, the little short sentence, "I will rise," I can just imagine her like standing up as she says it and just, you know, even though she's like, it's metaphorical, but to just put the emphasis on it, it's just like, "I will rise." There's periods throughout this. And there's not always punctuation in poetry, even within her poetry. But I like the periods here because it's like, "I will teach her not to cower," period. It's like that is a full stop right there. That is what needs to be said. "I will teach her not to cower." There's a real strength in the way that this is put together. At the beginning, it's more like... well, not a huge section, but there's some that are a stanza. There's lines that are together, but it gets broken up as it goes because it's like these are individual statements that are all really important. I like the line, "I am becoming a masterpiece of strength that they can't steal." That is just a fantastic line. Robbie, would you like to comment?
Well, it's amazing when you come across a piece of work, a piece of poetry that speaks so much on your own experience. It's like it's a shared experience almost, or it's like they spend time in your own head. Because, like for myself, I feel like I'm finally becoming my best version of myself. I'm finally getting the opportunity to become like my, you know, most authentic version of me, And with this here, it's just going back to the poem here again for a sec. And I'm just looking over one or two parts. But yeah, there's just so many little bits where it feels like the things that I've said to myself, like I'm here to reclaim my precious life. Like I'm really reclaiming my time and for what I want to do. And she just put it so well here. And it's just gratifying when you come across a piece that reminds you that someone else is going through the same journey that you are.
And I think that's an important part of art and why writing and poetry and all of that is so important, that because we can find people we relate to, we can find the knowledge that we are not alone in what we are feeling. Poetry tends to show people their internal side and get to see, you know, the way that other people's minds or emotions might reflect their own. It can also show you how people are different and in interesting ways and help you understand other perspectives. But seeing yourself in someone's writing can be very gratifying. And sometimes, you know, writing about difficult topics, you know, trauma and all the hard things can be important because someone might see that they're not alone, and that can make a big difference. So good for Avelina for sharing something for people to be empowered by. Our next one to the same prompt is called Public Service, and that's by Time Teller. Robert, would you please read that for us?
I will try. The potholes break suspensions, expensive fixing vehicles these days, and the water pumps out of the ground, running down the road and freezing at night into films of black ice. Persephone dawdles her way, continually glancing over her shoulder back to her master, whose pain can be heard howling around the chimneys in winter skies. I saw a crow yesterday. His eyes looked tired and worn down by endless repetitive competition from his peers. Of course, he looks tired, said the old man in the food bank queue. He lives longer. The robin, its feisty defense of an area around this queue, lives briefly and has no time to be tired. Fast hearts beat at evolution's chest until arrhythmia cracks open the rib cage and lets leash tation with its youthful surge of fairness and right from wrong. The old crow pecks at the worm, but decides the fast food chips discarded by overfilled bins have more going for it. Carcinogens taste good. In fact, all good things kill you in the end. Six deeds, six chances, and the binary coded gods of trials and initiative burn the flesh as if we are witches, yet we follow the one. Hades waits patiently, knowing nature brings us all, like falling leaves, to his feet. End poem.
That was a fantastic read, and I really, really love this piece. Again, it uses multiple prompts because it brings in the Persephone one, which is later talked about in prompt 3. So it works with the arguing with nature. She's wise and innocent and cruel. The rage and hurt and blood and pain are hers. But it also works with the nature lost a daughter who remains six seeds of pomegranate dead today. It specifically uses the six seeds and Persephone directly, which I'm glad that other people got the name right, because it's driving me crazy. I love the Persephone myth, and I said Penelope earlier, and I'm glad Persephone is getting her justice here. That it uses a crow is also just lovely. Crows are in so many different deep, dark storytelling, and think of their familiar connection to the ravens, who they look a lot like, and how they are in so many myths. And the raven having its age be a part of things, and how it has that tired look because it has to go through more than the robin, and it's been through so much, and it's choosing the wrong thing because it tastes better at the time, which is something that most of us are guilty of. And I like how Time Teller just, like, says it straight. Carcinogens taste good. All good things kill you in the end. It's true, you know. The food that tastes good, the alcohol, the smoking, so many vices that feel good at the time but are bad for you. I like that he uses the six seeds, the six chances, And the way that it talks about, like, the burn the flesh as if we are witches, because it hurts us to do those things. And then the burning of the flesh makes me think of hell, which is, you know, part of the Persephone myth. And yet we follow the one. And I really love the last line. Hades waits patiently, knowing nature brings us all like falling leaves to his feet. That's a beautiful way of saying that, well, we're all going to die. It's gorgeously worded and terrifying at the same time. Robbie, what were your thoughts?
Well, the imagery here is so unique, and yet you didn't get lost in it. Sometimes when imagery is really unique, you kind of spend so much time puzzling over it that you get lost in that or distracted from the poem in doing that. But that's not the case here. And I like the use of the robin or the birds in general here. I had a kind of a soft, gentle smile when he mentioned the crow, when they mentioned the crow, because I was remembering at the marina, there was a crow that was, it seemed to be the same one. It had very much a distinct look. And, the crow is always at the marina, and it just, sometimes you come across something in nature, something very specific that has just a gentle or peaceful energy to it. And he'd be there at the back of the marina, always sitting on the electrical wires. And I got to a point where I nicknamed him. I named him Nero, and I have some pictures of him, actually. And the part where it talks about that nature has, it's feisty, defensive, an area around this cute and has no time to be tired. It made me think of nature and its perpetual efforts for itself. And again, it made me think of birds here, because there's red-winged blackbirds at the marina that have this one little area that they defend, and they defend it fiercely. Like, you cannot come within, like, meters of it. And to me, that's, like, a really good manifestation or showing of how nature is always defending itself. And so it was nice to see that kind of that expression of how nature like acts on its own behalf. And of course, that carcinogens taste good. That really grabbed my attention too. I sometimes joke, I say, you know, why is it that human beings don't crave Brussels sprouts? Why do they always crave all the fats and everything? I know it's because fats or what, like your stores for, you know, like later on and all that. So that's why we crave that. And unfortunately, we're able to make so many of those foods now that we have more than we could ever hope to need. But yeah, it really is true that so many of the things that taste the best are the things that have the worst things in them. So it was good to see that. And I kind of was wondering where it says the binary coded gods of trials and initiative. It made me wonder if it's like referring sort of to technology and how it's integrated into our lives, especially thinking of the UPC code that we see on everything, because that's like a coded thing, you know, that's so much a part of our lives. And it's kind of like almost like a god, you know, because, and it mentions that, like, yet we follow the one, you know, like we're in nature and everything, and yet we're kind of enslaved to this, things like this, you know, the UPC code that like runs the world.
Mhm. And Robert, what were your thoughts?
Well, I like the idea, the cycle of perpetuity, you know, temptation, and like we're all basically enslaved to our temptations and stuff. A lot of times people can have, you know, willpower or whatever, but it never lasts. Well, it doesn't usually last. Sometimes you can break the habits, but then you just get another one, you know. And this, I like this, the whole idea about the where does it say? The old crow pecks at the worm, but decides that the food chips discarded by overfilled bins have more going for it. And then, of course, the carcinogens taste good. You know, I always thought that that was interesting, that there it's kind of like a almost like a cosmic joke that we're born to want all these things that are so terrible for us. And it's just one of those things about being human, you know, like because the animals, they're just fine. They eat what they need to eat. But in this one, he even included the animal to kind of take on some of our bad habits. So I thought that was kind of like a thing to where we become kind of like toxic to existence itself and the environment. I thought that was a little jab there, and I thought that was nice. But yeah, the last line, like you pointed out, Feliciana, was Hades waits patiently, knowing nature brings us all like falling leaves to his feet. Like, because in the end, we all do have to pay the piper, and we have to, whether it be through temptation or other means, we find our end, and there's no getting around it. So, this is a great piece. It really made me think, and especially the part with the birds, and that was really nice. And I like all the little hidden messages in there. So, yeah, well, very well done.
So I was looking at pomegranates while you guys were commenting, still listening, of course, but I was curious about why it would be six seeds specifically, although that is partly because it's the 6 months of the year that she has to stay below. But also, for some reason, I came across that in Judaism, pomegranates are believed to have 613 seeds because the Bible has 613 commandments. And it's like there's a certain thing about, like, the numbers line up. And then Buddhism has something with it, and Christianity has something. It's like the pomegranate shows up in all different kinds of religions. There are many, many. And apparently in medieval paintings, they would use the pomegranate to be blood, especially if it had something to do with either Jesus or a unicorn. If they were showing blood on Jesus or a unicorn, they would use pomegranate. I don't know. That blew my mind. So when I was specifically trying to find, because he's what the part where it said the binary coded gods of, and I was just curious if there's something about, like, the numbers, because binary code uses a lot of numbers, and that's what came up. So it was just interesting to me, even though I don't think it was the answer relating to the poem. It's anyway, yeah. Pomegranate, something I'm gonna look into.
Yeah, well, some older family members of mine used to use it, a pomegranate, because they have pomegranate trees, and they used to use it in their artworks and stuff as well. So, yeah, that's interesting.
And there's something I saw, too, about the number six being involved with the UPC code, with something about the number of spaces in between each bar or something like that, as a kind of an odd theory about things and all that. I really wish I remembered more about it. But yeah, somehow the number six is involved in the UPC code as well. So it's probably an unintended coincidence, but it's interesting when the things line up like that and just kind of all weave together.
Cool. Okay, so I think, Robert, you read that one, right?
Yep.
Yep, okay. So that means I'm going to get Robbie to read the next one by Ken Smith.
Okay. Turn back far enough, and we will see the calendar divided in three seasons in the days of early Greece. as crucial as migrating birds for the hunter-gatherers of the Scottish Isles. Spring, summer, autumn, winter was discounted, a downtime of slumber. And how is Christianity to deal with this pagan belief? Why overlap it and conceal it? Create a religious holy trinity, a god, split three ways to bury the ancient system. But dig the heathen fingers deep into the ground, and there the old stone calendars will be found. End poem.
Ooh. Oh, I like the way you emphasize certain words there, and you sound very ominous, like, will be found.
I studied this a really... lot, so I...
I really like the pagan feel of this because I'm a bit of a pagan myself, and I just as much as it doesn't get into a lot of details, it's that emphasis on the importance of the seasons and the ancient kind of way of looking at time, and then how that was kind of commandeered and changed to suit the changing of, you know, popularity of various religions, but for it to connect with the nature, I think works well with the quote of where are we now? Because we're on prompt Q. There is no arguing with nature, and there is no arguing with the seasons. We can't, as much as we would like to, sometimes control what the weather is going to be. It depending on where you live, I guess what you can do is move to a place with different climate. But the seasons can't help but influence the way that we live. You know, I'm Canadian. In most places in Canada, really feel the weather. In all seasons, it changes pretty dramatically. So you're influenced by it. And the birds migrating, the changing for hunting and gathering, you know, it's talking about Scotland and across the world, we're very influenced by nature's clock. So I thought that he did a good job at pointing that out. Robert, what were your thoughts on the poem?
I could appreciate. I like when people use the seasons in poetry as well. Spring, summer, and autumn. I'm a bit bummed though that winter was discounted because winter is my favorite. But it's probably because I'm biased and I live in the desert. But anyways. I like the create a religious holy trinity, a god split three ways to bury the ancient system. To me, it seems like it's kind of poking at the fact that the Christianity really kind of did its thing in commandeering certain aspects of different cultures and whatnot. And that's why it says they did it to bury the ancient system, you know, to take it and this is ours now, kind of how like the Romans did, for you know the Roman and then the Greek took a bunch of Greek gods and stuff like that. But anyways, there was a lot of beauty in it as well. I like the last stanza most of all, but dig the heathen fingers deep into the ground and there. The old stone calendars will be found, you know, like the title of the poem says, turn back far enough. Like you go deeper and deeper into history and, you know, more of the truth. And I also think it really goes with the prompt in the sense that there is no arguing with nature for she is wise and innocent and cruel. Because nature is all of those things. Like it's beautiful, and yet it can be very frigid at times. And I really thought he encompassed it well. Like he really did well in nailing the prompt, in my opinion. So, yeah, well done.
I agree. Robbie, what did you think?
Well, I enjoyed reading this for the fact that this is something, like I said, that I study. And it's just something I happen to come across, even if it's not what I'm studying, because just what I read about so many times has this in the material. And so that's why I felt like you were mentioning, you know, about where I emphasize the words and that and the tone. And it just, yeah, like I just left a comment on the poem, on the page there. And like I felt like this is something that I connect to because I read it so much. And so that it made me feel like I knew where the emphasis was supposed to be and such. And there are a lot of the same points I found as Robert was mentioning, like about how the traditions are subsumed. And the thing is, when you subsume a tradition and, you know, whatever religions they happen to be, you know, the thing is what you do usually is that you take what's already there and you adapt it to your own traditions as opposed to starting something completely new, because it's like more pragmatic and more, it's easier to do. And I love the ending as well, like, you know, digging the heathen fingers deep. And the thing is, you know, you can try to hide where all of traditions first started, but it's, you know, somewhere along the line, you're going to see the things that, all the things that line up. And you say, oh, wait a minute, there's three of this here, or you know, this god and this god. It's like Greek and Roman, right? Gods and goddesses, like they're so similar, and you know, you see the evidence of how, you know, like Jupiter, I think, and Zeus are like, you know, the same thing essentially. So it was nice to see that pointed out so well here.
Yes, I agree. Our next poem by Weaver of Dreams actually has an audio with it, which is awesome. Thank you, Weaver, for usually making us an audio. So I'm going to play that if I can find it. And now I have it. Oh, there it is.
When night is drowned, tempest fiercely blew, where fury dwells, and rage is born anew. Behold all the might of elements untamed, a symphony of chaos, a melody unchained. Thunder's angry roar echoes across the sky, lightning chases leaves that are eager to fly. Dark clouds converge, wrath in every hue, nature's rage is unleashed for all to view. The winds howl, carrying a primal scream, cyclones whirl, the destruction is extreme. Trees once standing tall tremble and bow, while torrents of rain flood valleys below. Yet amidst all this chaos great beauty lies. The power is immense, captivates our eyes.
That was wonderful, Weaver. Thank you for the audio and for the poem. I thought this was beautiful. I like that it rhymes. I like that it personifies nature so well, with anger, the rage, the howling of the wind, and to see that it's chaos, but also great beauty. That it's a symphony of chaos. I like that. There are all different kinds of kind of instruments of nature. You have the wind in the trees, the thunder, the animals, so much different elements that are making noise, and it all goes together in that symphony. And it's not just noise as in noise that we hear, but just all of the elements creating the life of the wild, to carrying a primal scream. I really like that. The primal kind of like anger, like that you feel is expressed through a cyclone, about the rage in the storms. It's easy to think of natural disasters as a kind of anger, and they're often used as metaphors for the anger that humans feel, and yet these things are not, you know, inherently evil or anything. It is said in a way that works with this, because she is innocent and cruel. Everything is hers: the rage, the hurt, the pain. As it says in the prompt, she captured that all really nicely, and it's succinct. You know, it's not a super long poem, but it gets its message across, and it's just beautiful. Robert, would you like to comment?
Yeah, I thought this was a very powerful and beautiful. I know from what Weaver's work before, I never got to see this type of like raw, just untamed, you know, destruction just let loose in her poetry. But she still, like, her reading voice kind of lulls you into it no matter what. But the where's the stand at? Thunder's angry roar echoes across the sky. Lightning chases leaves that are eager to fly. I thought that was so brilliant, because if you think about the leaves being blown into the wind, like how it is in the picture, and then you can just picture the lightning, like kind of like caressing the clouds and stuff along with the leaves, and it just really paints this picture in your head. And then of course the other senses get teased as well, with the winds howling, like you mentioned, the primal scream, and I thought that was great. But then in the end, like due to all the natural disasters and the destruction and all that, it paves the way for new life and new things to grow, such like a volcano, you know, when a volcano erupts and releases all the magma, and there's very fertile ground because of the ash, you know. So I really thought she encapsulated the fury so well, and also the beauty of it, in the circle. So very well done, Weaver. And I always like hearing you read.
That was an excellent comment. Thank you. Robbie, would you like to comment?
Well, it gave the nature a very kinetic feel. All the things that happen in nature that are very moving and very dynamic. And I thought it was especially like the the anger of nature, like its more vicious side. And I thought of two things that I witnessed personally, where there was a mini tornado here, which is so unusual. Like, we're pretty disaster proof here. Like, no real disasters happen, but I'll never forget it, because there's that eerie stillness. And what really got me was the sky was green. Like, it was literally this weird green. And when I smelled ozone, I smelled a metallic sound and a metallic smell in the air, and I thought to myself, that's ozone. And I was like, oh boy, I had better get home, and I better get home now. And sure enough, you know, it was a mini tornado. And there's another time here where the thunder was so intense, it shook my whole apartment. Like, it really shook it. And I thought to myself, there's nowhere I can go. It's like the entire sky is bearing down on me. And that was, I actually found that
more frightening than the mini tornado. And so it made me think of those two events and how it's just once nature gets to a certain point in its fury, it's literally unescapable because you're like right in the midst of nature. It's not like you can go to the basement and hunker down, like the wind or, you know, the earthquake is just, the wind is going to rip the foundations right down to your basement. Or if it's an earthquake, then, you know, it'll shake the foundations maybe of your house, and that's like just such a terrifying prospect when that sort of thing happens. And of course there's the whole cycle of renewal amongst the destruction. In the end, yet amidst all this chaos, great beauty lies. And I always think that that's such an important point to make, because it's easy to show nature as all of one thing or another when it's both.
Yeah,
yes,
that,
it is both. Sorry, go ahead, Robert.
I was just going to throw in one thing, is because you were talking about earthquakes, and one of my favorite quotes from the Magic the Gathering card was, there's a card called Spitting Earth, and it says, where do you run when the ground is your enemy? You know, so it's like, yeah. But anyways, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I like that. Where do you run when the ground is your enemy? I guess to the sky, but when the sky is the enemy, you do go underground. No, that's it's
this
true.
This is a quote for Magic the Gathering card.
That could be a contest. It really could. They also have amazing art sometimes.
There
All right, that needs to be a contest.
I'll send you the one.
Send
from
me
Jack
some good
Black Blade.
Yes. That's awesome. I will seriously do a contest on that. Okay. Our last one to that particular quote is Nature's Labor by M. Clare. Bodies born with pain built in, every line divine, the roots of trees, mapping agony, eternally etched in stretched skin, a sin forever marks her flesh. Take this, all of you, and eat from it, and devour my body and destroy my soul. Is it God the creator or Mother Nature? Our father hath bore no child, and I am the product of my mother's blood shed. My faith lies with her rage. Scarlet burns white hospital sheets as the cycle repeats with a wailing scream which rings in the ears of the earth's crust. Her tectonic plates illuminate with magma fury and eyes well up, blurry, a flurry of rain pelts, and skin melts to be stitched up again with thread. End poem. Robert, would you like to comment?
Yeah, that was, wow. There's a whole lot packed in there, because, first of all, the title, Nature's Labor, you know, in her author's notes, she put, I immediately was drawn to the idea of childbirth, having experienced it myself. And right from those first stanzas, without seeing that, I know that's what I thought about, you know, because, you know, where it says bodies born with pain built in, every line divine, the roots of trees mapping agony, eternally etched in stretched skin, a sin forever marks the flesh. So I thought that was just brilliant, because right off the bat I was like, oh man, that sounds like you know, when you know the woman's pregnant, she gets the stretched marks and things like that, and then obviously the veins and all that gets stretched out and mapped out. So like, I thought that was beautiful the way she did that. And then she gets really profound and passionate, and maybe it's just the way you read it too, because you were just into it in that read. But where it says, take this, all of you, and eat from it, and devour my body and destroy my soul. Is it God the creator or Mother Nature? Our father hath bore no child, and I am the product of my mother's bloodshed. My faith lies with her rage. So basically, you know, like he's like, I don't see him giving birth. I don't see him doing nothing. He's like, but Mother Earth, on the other hand, is over here, you know, giving us all this result. So, you know, my faith lies with her, you know. So I thought that was a very interesting and captivating way of putting that. I don't know. I think this is probably one of my favorite rites of the night, because it was very profound and very relatable to kind of put us on that. Me, obviously, I'm a man, but to put, you know, humankind in tandem with that of, you know, Mother Nature herself, you know, like to compare that we are nature. You know, I thought that was great, great, right?
Oh, I love that end of your comment. We are nature, and I yes, we are. I love that. I was really captured by this. The stretch marks got me right away. Every line divine, the roots of trees mapping agony. That is such a beautiful way to talk about stretch marks. Oh my God, I love it. But then it talks about a sin forever marks her flesh. So, you know, it's like if it was an unwanted pregnancy or one that people disapproved of, then that it's marked, marking her as with that sin. But I think for the most part, this is just, about like kind of like the positive side of having stretch marks. My little nephew, accidentally walked in on my mother changing, and she has stretch marks, and, he was like, Grandma, I didn't know you were a tiger. And so he was like, so proud. And he was like, my grandma's a tiger.
That's awesome.
That's so cute. Did you know grandma's a tiger? I'm like, yes, she is. I just immediately thought of that when it was like the strength of the stretch marks. Because he didn't see it as ugly. He was so proud of it. The power there of saying that Mother Nature is the one that should get the credit. You know, he bore no child. My faith lies with her rage. This also kind of gives me an impression of like, kind of like a deadbeat dad kind of thing, where maybe the narrator's father or possibly baby daddy did not, you know, do his part and help take care of the child afterwards. But in a way, it's accusing God of this. It's like if you, you know, created mother. Gave Mother Nature the opportunity to bear this this nature, then what have you done to take care of us afterwards? It's kind of a cute, I don't know, I see it as a bit of an accusation at God, like Mother Nature is angry because she hasn't had the support to, you know, keep the life going that she has created and that she suffered for. I really like the use of the tectonic plates here, and the magma fury with the pelt of the rain, like the rain just pelting down and through the tears, and then just like the brutality of like needing to be stitched up again. Like that's it's not the kind of thing that they show in like, you know, sitcoms when they have a baby. It's like, oh, it's all happy and good. But also, ow, I actually haven't given birth, but just from my friend's perspective, ow. And I think this does like a wonderful job of just, you know, giving credit to the mothers and to Mother Nature for doing the work. This was awesome. I really, really enjoyed it. Robbie, did I get you to comment yet?
I zoomed in a lot on that too, with the whole God versus Mother Nature, and it kind of felt to me like, well, it's like showing God as this, like, maybe like this generative force, but it afterwards is in the background. It's kind of like creation is done. I'm just laying out here chilling now, but with nature, nature's always active in its creation. It's always ongoing, and it's just one of those, that part of the poem, it just gets my head spinning, you know. It's just so many potential ways that the author is presenting it or is thinking of it, and it's just a mark of a good poem when, you know, a poem really gets you thinking and you think to yourself, well, you know, it could be any one of these, you know, 3, 4, 5, or 6 things. I enjoyed that, the poem, for the fact that it did that. And it definitely, I felt like, you did do a good read, because you put in the feeling of, like, the anguish of nature more than anything. And I think that's what was intended in the poem. So it was good to hear that.
Thank you. It looks like we have a new caller. May I ask who's calling?
Ravenous.
Oh, hey. How's it going, Ravenous?
It's going.
Did you hear that last poem, Nature's Labor?
I did not. I jumped in while you were talking about tiger stripes.
Ah. Okay, that's fine. We'll catch you for a comment on the next one. nothing like stretch marks to get you welcomed to the show. we're now on to prompt 3, which is, we build rituals of mourning and acceptance to walk us through the nights of tears and pain. But nature lost a daughter who remains 6 seeds of pomegranate dead today. So we'd already talked a little bit about that in terms of it being Persephone and the 6 pomegranate seeds keeping her under, and how Demeter used that as when she was going to be willing to provide us with grain and harvest, and not the times where she does not have her daughter. She does not produce. So that is a nature's ritual of mourning. And we can get into some of our own. So I'm going to put the first response to that up, and that's by Crawthorn. Crawthorn actually gave me an audio, so I'm going to play that.
When love is seeded with decline, a sonnet. A viscous gem that twangs with bloody death was snuck upon my tongue with loving words. The pomegranate seed that sucks ripe breath from stirring pears and weathered singing birds. In furrowed flesh the germs of blight will grow, disguised as kernels prized by seeking hearts. And frozen pools of winter mirrors show device and trick in hand with sunny starts. Undressed for sleep in nights of ice and gloss, I wash my eyes with brushes from the past to paint back smiles and lose the moulding moss that swallows spring and makes a mouth downcast. Decaying fruit becomes a bodied wine, and spilling sips the robbers of love shine.
That was a beautiful audio. Thank you so much, Crawthorn, for giving us that. I always appreciate receiving audio versions of people's poems so we get to hear it in their own voice. I like the idea of a viscous gem a vicious gem. The thought of, you know, bloody death being connected to something beautiful, it seems contradictory. But those pomegranate seeds, the way that it describes it as sucks ripe breath. So because in a way it was her death, but you would, it kind of reverses things because, you know, she sucks the seeds and they suck her breath away. The way that it talks about the furrowed flesh, it's, you know, it's kind of like a disgusting thing when you think about it, the germs and the blight. But the way that it's written, in furrowed flesh with germs of blight will grow, it sounds beautiful, and the way that she read it sounded beautiful. I think that's partly the alliteration there, but it's just amazing how she could do something that's, like, disgusting and make it pretty. Where is it here? Decaying fruit becomes a bodied wine, and spilling sips the robbers of love shine. So it's true. The death of fruit becomes something that people enjoy, the wine, by fermenting things and taking them once they're, you know, past their prime, we end up making things that are actually, in a way, more valuable. I mean, you would pay more for the wine than you would for the rotten grapes. And it's like we appreciate things sometimes afterwards. And so that makes sense with the thought of grieving and this prompt of, you know, rituals of mourning and acceptance. Sometimes something or someone seems even better once they're lost, because we look at them in kind of a different perspective of just focusing on the good, perhaps. This is really beautifully written, and was a great read. Robert, would you like to comment? Sorry, we lost Robert. He's dropped. So, Ravenous, would you like to comment on the poem?
Yeah, I will. I'll comment. Sorry, I'm a little tired. I'm gonna get my thoughts straight here, but I really liked the last two lines. Decaying fruit becomes a bodied wine, and spilling sips the robbers of love's shine. That kind of honing in on that decaying fruit becomes a bodied wine. Like, I get this concept of, you know, life as it seems like it is dying, something beautiful can come from it still. I don't know, just them last two lines really popped out to me, but the way that she read this whole thing, I'm with you, and like some of it has darker meaning in behind the words, but it just come across very beautifully. This is darkness done very, very, very beautifully. I thoroughly enjoyed hearing it being spoken to us, and then also reading it. So,
thank you, Robbie. Would you like to comment as well?
Well, I thought of all the kind of foods that it's even more broad than you even initially think. Like I thought about milk and how it turns into cheese, and then cottage cheese, and it's just a funny little quirk about nature, how, like, aside from things like we're mentioning before about, you know, the ash and everything, like say when a forest burns down, you know, and everything gets recycled in that. And, like, even with things like food, it's funny how something else can come out of rot and such. And actually, there's something that this poem reminded me of about poetry in general that I meant to mention in another poem. It's poetry's quirky ability to make something that is ugly or is thought of as not pleasant sound
And I don't think any other art form really does that. And it's kind of, it can be a fun exercise to do that in poetry where, you know, you take something that is generally thought of, it's not too pleasant, and you make it sound beautiful or pleasant. And all of these poems that we've been reading tonight, there's that common theme of because it's Mother Nature, I see it here, like the vicious gem that twangs of bloody death. It's continuing that idea, that theme of nature having both a beauty in it and ugliness, but especially violence. In this case, violence. And it's just it's a fascinating thing to contemplate. And I see it continued on in here. So I was just looking at the last part here. Molding moss. I like that part especially too, for as a portrayal of, you know, nature's rot and then how it's like recycling into something else.
You know, I think that whole thing of making something that's usually ugly beautiful is perfect for our show. I mean, part sinner, part saint. I tend to do like the contrast of the dark and the beautiful, and I think that may have to be a contest of turn something ugly into something beautiful, or turn something beautiful into something ugly, or both within the same poem. Okay, this is the second time I've gotten excited about a possible prompt because of something you said, Robbie, but I have the worst memory ever, so maybe send me a message.
Can you only message me? Is that it?
Yes.
I'll message you afterwards, and just so you have the note. I'll message you a sticky note, a virtual sticky note.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Ravenous, are you on AP right now? Like, I sent you the next poem. Can you see that?
Yes, I see it.
Would you be willing to read that one for me?
Sure will. This is Unicorn of the Universe by Chrysalis 333. It starts out with the prompt, we build rituals of mourning and acceptance to walk us through the nights of tears and pain. But nature lost a daughter who remains 6 seeds of pomegranate dead today. And then the poem begins this, through a keyhole, benevolent stranger stares into reflections, where tears are temples, bardic flutes carved from each sleeping spleen cell. Walking, waking, shards clinging to the soles of my feet. Once wild horses freed their manes, galloping hooves carved their signature. Oh, wild mare, you live still. Free from all stables, unsaddled, uninhibited. Free grazing tundric formations. Once winged, a winding wind, I was allowed this transition to experience emotions. From torso I arise, my garmented soil. Oh, fickle flame, fermented scent, behold, become a smoldered whisper. End poem.
That was an excellent read. Thank you. I really like your reading voice. This is a powerful one. I like that it uses, the font to change things as well. Like, it's all caps for through. It's like, it really emphasizes that part. And then the horses are an interesting way to go with that. And I think horses are a really good way to talk about the lack of freedom, the losing of your freedom, because they were so wild and, covered a big chunk of land and moved all the time. They didn't, they weren't still or solitary in their wild form. But now, with humans, they're put into their stables. They don't get to run around to the same extent. Sometimes they're isolated or only with a couple of horses instead of a big herd. And to have that desire for being unsaddled, for being free of those stables, it works with the Persephone myth because, you know, she gets stuck in one place and she loses her freedom because she eats those six pomegranates, those six seeds of the pomegranate. And it depends because, you know, in some myths, and we've done other episodes about it, you know, she's chosen this life and she has fun ruling in hell with Hades. But in some versions, you know, it's horrible. She's his captive. So this makes me think about how she is most of the time in the stables, so to speak. She's locked up, but a couple months a year, he lets her go up to see her mother and have the freedom of being on earth. And so those horses have some free time to run around. And maybe that's kind of us. If you think about, like, if you're normally working and you're in your kind of routine and you're in your little cubicle, which is your stable, and you have to be a certain way and, you know, fit within that keyhole, we're put in a box, so to speak. But when you have vacation or, you know, that little rare time, you get to be your natural self. You know, you let down your, it's talking about freeing their manes, you let down your hair and you have that, you know, different version of yourself that goes free. I feel like it's talking about humans here as much as it's talking about the mist and the horses. I also really like the alliteration of fickle flame fermented, and that it has the last couple words by themselves, behold, become, and then that a smoldered whisper is like kind of separate. This makes me want to actually whisper that part, like a smoldered whisper. this is my instinct there. Yeah, I really enjoyed this. Ravenous, you got to read it. Do you have any thoughts about the poem?
Yeah. So I don't know. I love how even though technically it has you know, length to it, I would still consider this a form of brevity when so much is said in, you know, such few sets of words. Once wild horses freed their manes, galloping hooves carved their signature, oh, wild mare, you still live. That short little section right there, I just kind of, you know, I was able to have an image thrown in my head of just these wild, majestic horses just, you know, running through the plains and the wind whisking their hair back. Is they're just wild and free. And I don't know, I really enjoyed reading this, and I enjoyed a lot of the wording that was put into it.
Me too, thank you. And Robbie, what did you think?
Well, it got me thinking about the horseshoes, because it's one of those little factoids, little facts of life that I keep forgetting about, that I thought about that when I was younger, but it did not sound like a pleasant process. And you know, what does horse actually feel? You can't always jump to conclusions and just, like, you can't assume necessarily that it's just this absolutely horrible process, but I have the feeling that it probably is. There was a unique title, Unicorn of the Universe, that kind of made me think about the purpose of the title, like, because unicorns are, you know, these unique mythical animals, and so it was making me think about what is it that the person, that the author is trying to convey that's, like, maybe unique and fantastical in this poem. And I like that, through a keyhole, benevolent stranger stares into reflections. whenever I think of somebody peeking through a keyhole, it's just such a potent image because, you know, it's such a I don't know how to say it, but it you know, I think like an Alfred Hitchcock movie, you know, when someone's like peeping through a keyhole and they're seeing what they're not supposed to see, you know, it's just like, it's hard to look through a keyhole, and usually when you're looking through a keyhole, you're trying to see what you're not supposed to see, right? So there's kind of a potent image there and a potent idea, and this is one of those poems where I kind of want to go over a couple of the parts again to see what it is exactly that the author is using, like a certain image to convey. And looking here at once wild horses freed their manes, galloping hooves, and it's just there's a lot of playing around with the idea here of what that whole process means of a horse becoming domesticated. And I remember one of my poetic friends, she was talking about how she's called Spirit Wild. That's one of her nicknames, because she was able to break the horses without the bridle, like the mouthpiece. And she was able to tame them without, you know, that cruel little bit. And so, yeah, there's a lot in here in this poem that I want to ponder on and think about. And lastly, I love the image at the end, a smoldered whisper. Like that there, that's like a whole poem in and of itself, or potential for a poem.
And that brings us to what you were saying near the beginning of the show, where it makes you want to write because you're like, oh, that could be a prompt. Which, again, every 2 minutes, I'm like, I should write about that. I should make a contest. And then, luckily, these are recorded, so I can go back and take notes about all the things that I said I was going to do. Maybe.
I've been made on my phone. I almost forgot one of the poems.
All right. We have 3 minutes left. So, yes, Ravenous, I can squeeze one in for you if it's a brief one. You want to send that to me?
Yeah. It's brief enough. I got to get this thing copied over to you real quick. Let's see. Come back over here. Click. Click. Boom. It's a good
there
song, by the way.
Okay. I'm going to post that. You go ahead and give that a read for us. Thank you.
Okay, this is titled Soliloquy of the Broken. I am on the edge of a lecherous ledge, a sable obsidian sword named Darkness, with its sharpness soothing and soft, a double-bladed, famished, infinite abyss. Till I fall, I am upon the bed of death and death, with bleeding black rose petals for decor, accompanied, of course, by numerous nuances of their piercing poison thorn. Shall I sleep? I am, hearing a dissonant, delightful song, playing despair, devoid of feral or fair, and a beautied, hateful love, a ribbon rubbish waltzes there. Shall I dance? I am, viewing a menagerie of perilous pathways, no way of knowing of where each goes, lust calls with caressing whispers, as the shattering silent wind blows. Shall I follow? I am, finding myself, fighting to fail and fall into that blackest of blacks, a serene siren's call, lulling me to sleep and dream to drearily dance with darkness, death, love, lust, and pestilence. Shall I stay? Their prey, their truth, their prayers, and their wishes too. I am, in poem.
Ooh, I love that. So we've been cut off for the live recording, but for the live show, but we can still be recording for another few minutes. So it's recording for the downloadable people. I loved the repetition in here, the I am, that happens in between each stanza, and that it asks a question, but that the question changes. Shall I fall? Shall I sleep? Shall I dance? Shall I follow? Shall I stay? That really, you know, prepares you for the stanza that's coming and gets you excited about it. And just using those lines alone gets you kind of just the gist and the feel of what's going to happen. You also do excellent alliteration with the lecherous ledge and the sharpness, soothing, soft, dissonant, delightful, and just fabulous vocabulary throughout this. Ribboned rubbish, ribboned rubbish waltzes. It's a tongue teaser, but I love it. And like, you know, menagerie of perilous pathways. God, I love your word choices so much. It's like velvety. I don't know why that word comes to mind, but it's beautiful. It's dark and it's, I was going to say something like nuanced, and then I looked and it said nuanced, and then I just got like dazzled by the fact that I looked at that word as I was thinking it. Fantastic. Robbie, are you still with us?
Yeah, I'm still
here. Would you like to comment? Okay, great.
Well, when you had mentioned to me that your shows, like, you like to think of them as dark but digestible. Which I loved, and this poem is very much like that. It's got the dark edge, and I love the formatting overall. It's just wonderful, like the skulls in the background, and it's dark. You know, it's edgy, but it's not. I get turned off of poems that are like just dark for their own sake, or it's just like dark to the point of being, you know, absolutely morbid. But this isn't like that, and this is very much a wondering poem. And it's, but the I am, I found intriguing. It's like, I am doing these things. I'm doing this. I'm doing that as a life process. And I just found it particularly interesting because I have a poem called Simply I Am. But in that poem, it's I am this thing. I am that thing. And it's talking more about identity. So it's an interesting contrast for me to hear I am a thing, as in my poem, whereas you're doing I am doing this thing in life. So that was a really fun contrast for me to hear as I heard you read the poem.
Thank you both. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for sharing. And next week, we have, we're going to do the prompt 4, which had Patty Mike, Charlie Bottle, and Ben Hart write to it. And big surprise is Babbler is coming back. I am so thrilled. So Babbler was my co-host for a very long time, and then she had to be away for a while. But rumor has it she is returning next week if all goes well. So yay for Babbler. I'm really hoping that we get to hear from her next week. Spread the word so everyone shows up for the party. Thank you both for calling, and thank you so much also to Robert, who did have to leave a little bit early, but I really appreciate you being here, Robert and Robbie and Ravenous. You are all amazing, and I really appreciate having your comments.